Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Those of you who are here and those of you who are on the Zoom screen, we are continuing our series of great Jewish thinkers, great individuals who shaped Jewish life over the centuries. Jewish life is what it is, and Jews do what they do, largely because there were crucial individuals at crucial moments in history who shaped Jewish life in a very profound way. So we've been looking the last couple of weeks at the life and writings of Rabbi Yosef Caro. Yosef Caro, who was born in Spain and who lived through the most cataclysmic disaster of his period. The Holocaust of the 15th century was, of course, the expulsion of Spain of 1492, in which tens of thousands of people lost their lives to the Inquisition, and they lost all their belongings, and they became penniless immigrants. And as I explained to you last time, Rabbi Yosef Caro himself, who was born in Toledo in Spain, to a very prominent family, already at a very young age. So he was born in 1488. So in 1492, he was only 4 years old, but his family went from Portugal, from Spain to Portugal, and then from Portugal to Morocco, and then from Morocco to Greece, and from Greece to Istanbul to Turkey. And in other words, they were really immigrants on the run, really from the Inquisition and various other persecutions of the time. Eventually, he lands in Israel in Tzfat. And those of you who go to Tzfat will be able to visit the shul of Rabbi Yosef Caro and the kever of Rabbi Yosef Caro. And what we're going to try and do here in this shiurim is get a little bit of an insight into who was the man and what was he doing and why was he such a crucially important individual in Jewish life in general. He is his fame, of course, as we mentioned last week, he's called the Mechaber, which means the author. Generally speaking, of course, Jewish writings cite all sorts of authors. But when somebody cites the author without mentioning who his name is or what book we're talking about, it can only mean one person. The author means Rabbi Yosef Caro, who was the author of the Shulchan Aruch. He wrote the definitive code of Jewish law. And in order to write it, he engaged in a most spectacular, if you like, life of scholarship, of learning and teaching under really what I think are impossible circumstances of being an immigrant, of being penniless, of being persecuted, arriving in Tzfat, arriving in Tzfat in the early 1500s, there was no nefesh b'nefesh to welcome them, you understand? They were living in very, very primitive circumstances. It was boiling hot in the summer and freezing cold in the winter. And they had all sorts of difficulties to contend with, plagues and enemies of various sorts. Nevertheless, despite all this, he established a Torah center in Tzfat. And Tzfat really became what it became largely because of Rabbi Yosef Caro. It is associated with the Arizal and the teaching of Kabbalah, the teaching of Kabbalah. But actually, Arizal arrived many years after Rabbi Yosef Caro arrived, and he was a much younger contemporary of Rabbi Yosef Caro. But they knew each other and they worked together. And whereas Arizal really focused all his energy on the learning and the teaching of Kabbalah and mysticism, Rabbi Yosef Caro is focusing his energy on the learning of teaching of Halakha. Halacha of what really is the correct way to live as an Orthodox Jew. And our definitions today of how you keep Shabbos, how you keep Kashrus, how you do Bris Milah, how you keep Pesach, how you build a sukkah, all the details of halacha that we live with today, if somebody asks you, how do you know that's a kosher sukkah? How do you know you're keeping Pesach properly? You open the Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch is the textbook, right, of halacha. But how did he do it? And how did it work? And the truth is, I've been studying this for 40 years, really, halacha and the Shulchan Aruch, consulting the Shulchan Aruch. It still remains to be almost a mystery that one man under those conditions, without a hard disk and without a search machine and without books, right, doing manuscripts, he was really able to encompass the vast material of all the commentaries on the Talmud, the entire Talmud, Bavli and Yerushalmi, with all its commentaries, and of course all the writings of the Rambam and of Rashi and of Tosfos and everything. He encompassed everything, memorized it all, collated it all, and put it in what he called a Shulchan Aruch, meaning a laid table. The concept of a laid table is you come to a table, it's all there for you, you know, the salt is here, the butter is here, your knife and fork is here, everything is in its place. That was his genius, a genius of order and structure, in order that it could be possible. Yes, that's a good question. That's a good question. Books have been written about this subject. It's a very good question. He clearly had Talmidim. He had disciples who worked with him, and presumably they acted as scribes for him, right? But it wasn't like, let me pick up your question, actually, because it's an interesting one. You find, for example, the Arizal, I'm just going to contrast them a few times. The Arizal, his contemporary, who was writing and teaching Kabbalah, actually wrote himself nothing. All the writings of the Arizal were written by Reb Chaim Vital, who was his student and his scribe, and wrote all the books which are called the writings of the Arizal, were not written personally by the Arizal. They were written by Reb Chaim Vital, right? Under his supervision, and of course read and monitored and corrected and everything, but the actual act of writing, he delegated to his students. Reb Yosef Karo did not do that. Not only did he not do that, Reb Yosef Karo made sure that once he'd written the Shulchan Aruch, so just to give you a couple of pointers here, the Shulchan Aruch itself was completed in 1556, right? But he wanted this book of his to become a standard, and not only a standard, one would even say like the gold standard. He wanted it to be the gold standard of halachic practice, so he made sure that not only it was written, but that he went to he sent the manuscript to Venice, and it was in Venice was the place where it was printed, and in 1565 was the first printing of the Shulchan Aruch, and he in his lifetime saw six printings of the Shulchan Aruch. He lived to see six printings, and he lived to see his Shulchan Aruch becoming the standard book on the desk of basically every practicing rabbi and dayan, basically in the Jewish world. And it was the most extraordinary thing to do. Yes, you wanted to say something?
So sorry.
Oh, very good. Okay. So you're becoming already a yeshiva bacha by asking that question. You're becoming a yeshiva bacha. You're quite right. How do you know? That's the question you have to ask. You see a line in the Shulchan Aruch, you have to ask, how do you know it's correct? So then you have to drill deeper into it, and you find out that he's quoting the Talmud, he's quoting Maimonides, he's quoting Rashi, he's quoting Tosfos, he's quoting the Bavli, he's quoting Yerushalmi. In the few lines of the Shulchan Aruch is hidden an enormous amount of scholarship, which has been researched, which is all the commentaries deal with. And he very rarely, in fact, gives you his idea. All he's doing is he's giving you a consensus view. He's looking at all the different views. So let's say he will look at 10 different views on a particular subject. You know, if you build a sukkah and it's got a little space in the schach, does that invalidate the whole sukkah or not? Okay, so he'll look at the Rambam and the Ritva and the Rosh and the Ramban and the Meiri and everything, and he will give you a consensus ruling on it, right? And that was his brilliance, that he was able to pull together so many different schools of thought. And he didn't say, well, now my view is this. He would say, look, I've got a system here. I'm giving you, this is the rabbinic consensus, which everybody can live with. It's true that the Rashba says something else. That's true. And it's true that there's a Rashi somewhere else that says something else. But they are, if you like, a da'at yachid. They are sort of individual views. But the rabbinic consensus view is listed in the Shulchan Aruch in the most succinct and briefest way possible. Yes, you wanted to say something?
So, yes.
Okay, so let me take up both these points. Both these points are very relevant, and I thank you for mentioning them. I have touched on them a little bit in the last year, but are worth mentioning here. For example, you'll find one of the contemporaries of his, who was not living in Israel, but living in Prague, was the famous Maharal of Prague. So So he also lives in the 1500s. He's the same time as Rabbi Yosef Karo, right? And when he sees a Shulchan Aruch, he feels that giving people this shortcut, in a sense, to a psak halacha will stifle scholarship, will be, make people lazy. You don't have to delve into the Gemara and look at the Rambam and the Tosfos and the Rashi and everything. All you're going to do is open the book, you get the bottom line, thank you very much, paskan the halacha, and we go on. And people will be a bit lazy. That's what you're absolutely right. So this was a criticism voiced by the Maharal, also the Maharshal, who was a Rav Shlomo Luria, who lived in Krakow. The Yamshal Shlomo, he was also a great Rosh Yeshiva, and he also felt that having these shortcuts is going to make people not so interested anymore in delving into the deeper ideas of these things. So this is a very good point. You're absolutely right. In addition to it, there was another point, which was, in a sense, it undermined a little bit rabbinic authority. In other words, don't forget, the Shulchan Aruch then became the property, not just of every rabbi, but every balabo, every individual could have his Shulchan Aruch. He didn't have to ask his rabbi, and it became the Google. It was the Google of the time. Why ask the rabbi a shaila when you can Google the shaila and find out straight away, you know, what the answer is? Now, of course, you know and I know that Googling a shaila is a very dangerous activity. It's about equal to Googling if you have an illness and you Google what your illness is and what the medicine is. And if you speak to doctors today, they will tell you that one of their biggest problems is that patients turn up and say, I've got these and these symptoms. I know what it is. I've got this, that, and the other. I know for sure that I've read this article and that article. I know exactly what condition I've got. And I also know what the best treatment is because I've read this article and that article. All I want from you is a prescription to give me. In other words, they don't even ask the doctor for his view on the subject. Doctors complain about this a lot. And the truth is, rabbis similarly have a problem of that nature, that people come and ask them a shaila, and they've already done their Google research, right? And they think they know the answer already. But of course, the difficulty is the amount of information. The problem with Google is that there's a fantastic amount of good information out there and a fantastic amount of crazy information out there as well. Crazy people, there's no filter, right? There's no selectivity in it. You can get people writing things which is just absolutely off the wall. And you've got to know the difference between one and the other. So often when someone comes to ask a shaila, I can tell already from the way they're asking it that they've looked up certain unusual sources, and you first got to sort of show them that they're looking the wrong way. But anyhow, of course, that wasn't the case to such an extent then, but it is comparable in a sense. It's comparable. The great internet of the 16th century with printing. That was the great new technology of the 16th century, and that changed the way people thought, changed society. But, as I mentioned before, Rabbi Yosef Karo's great idea was that we need, because of the expulsion from Spain, and because the Jews of Spain and on Portugal and Greece and Turkey and Israel were all mixed together in communities, you needed to have a standardized halachic code of practice. You couldn't anymore have a Spanish Jew living in Tzfat keeping Shabbos like this, and a Greek Jew living in Tzfat keeping Shabbos like that, right? And one person davening like this and one person davening like that, the whole of Judaism becomes fragmented. So you need to have a Nusach Achid, right? And this was not an easy task. In fact, it was actually an impossible task, and the fact that he succeeded in it is nothing short of extraordinary, that such a person could succeed. The other point that you made is a very important point, which is that he had, of course, a bias, one would say, towards the Sephardic world. He himself was a Spanish Jew grown up in the Sephardi world, right? And therefore his tendency was to draw mainly on the opinions that came out of the Sephardic rabbinic world. And this then needed to be, when the Jews of Germany and Poland and Russia got the Shulchan Aruch, they said, wait a minute, our tradition is different because we are basing ourselves on Rashi and Tosfos and the great rabbis of Ashkenaz, right? So as I mentioned last time, the solution to that was Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramot of Krakow. So he took the Shulchan Aruch and amended wherever the Ashkenaz view was a bit different, he wrote emendations. And one of the interesting things is that Rabbi Yosef Karo still lived long enough to see in print a Shulchan Aruch with his text and the Ramaz text built into the Shulchan Aruch. And since then, in 1580, the first Shulchan Aruch was printed with the Ramosha Isalis's Ashkenaz emendations to it. And that gave a book which had much greater currency, so to speak, application, both in Ashkenaz, so both an Ashkenaz and Sephardic rabbi today can pick up the Shulchan Aruch, and where the Sephard disagrees with Ashkenaz, you get a difference of opinion between the two, and different traditions which exist ad hayom hazeh to this day. But that was really an amazing moment, really, in Jewish history. That we have today a book called the Shulchan Aruch, which holds Orthodox Jews together in their practice of Judaism in a way that before the Shulchan Aruch was unheard of. Before the Shulchan Aruch, each town, right, the Rashba was the rabbi of Barcelona. All the Jews in Barcelona kept Shabbos according to the Rashba. That's how it was, right, for a whole generation. But then Barcelona was no longer. After the expulsion from Spain, Barcelona, which was a magnificent Jewish community, was like Vilna and Odessa and Krakow after the Holocaust. It was nothing. It was wiped off the map as a Jewish center. And then all the Jews from there were exiled. But they still had their traditions from Barcelona, from Toledo, and therefore they needed a unification. So his book was a tremendous contribution to the unity of Am Yisrael. That Am Yisrael fight enough as it is. There are enough discussions and debates as it is, but at least they shouldn't have to fight about how to keep Shabbos and how to keep Pesach and how to build a sukkah. Yes, you want to say something? Very good. Excellent. It's a small example, but it's a good example. It's a good example, right? The Sfarad, he says, when you put on your tefillin, you should be sitting down. And Rav Moshe Isserles says, no, we have a tradition. When you're putting on tefillin, you should stand up, right? And for example, in tefillin, and the truth is today, these two schools of thought are still practiced, right? Another interesting distinction would be the question of wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Do you or do you not wear tefillin in Chol HaMoed, right? Now, I grew up in England, in an Ashkenaz community, where, of course, on Chol HaMoed, everybody wore tefillin. We wore tefillin on Chol HaMoed. The whole community wore tefillin, with a few exceptions. A few people from Hasidic origins didn't. But the general Ashkenaz practice of the Ramah is you put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Let me just explain to you that the Gemara says quite clearly that, of course, every weekday you wear tefillin, and every Shabbos and Yom Tov you don't wear tefillin. But the Gemara itself, the Talmud, does not say, what about Chol HaMoed? Because Chol HaMoed is a bit Yom Tov, and it's a bit not Yom Tov. Right, it has Yom Tov davening to a certain extent, Halal and Musaf, but it doesn't have all the halachic restrictions of Yom Tov. So it's a twilight zone between Yom Tov and Chol. So is there tefillin or isn't there tefillin? That is left as an open question in the Talmud, and therefore among the later commentaries of the Rishonim, there are different views. Right, so the minhag in Ashkenaz went down one route, that you do put on tefillin in Chol HaMoed, and the minhag in Sfarad went down the other route, that you don't put on tefillin Chol HaMoed, and that's true to this day, except in Israel, the Sfarad psak of not wearing tefillin has become dominant. So for the first time in my life, when I came on Aliyah, I didn't wear tefillin Chol HaMoed. That didn't matter. What did matter was that the more Hasidic communities, or people who came from Hasidic families, had the minhag not to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So that was a little bit of a, and in fact, in my shul, I was the rabbi of a shul there for 35 years. In my shul, I would say 80% of people did wear tefillin, but 20% of people came from more Hasidic origin backgrounds. They still had customs. I told them they've got to do what their father did. They've got to do, their father was Orthodox, they're going to follow their Orthodox minhag. I said to them, if you don't have a minhag from their father, if their father didn't wear tefillin because he wasn't Orthodox, that's not a minhag, you understand? That's unfortunate, right? So your father didn't wear tefillin because he wasn't observant, so then you've got to do the minhag of the shul, and the minhag of the shul is that you do wear tefillin because it's a minhag Ashkenaz, that's the Ramah. And there are 1,000 details like that. This is only one of them that is more well-known and more widely practiced. Yes, David? There is something. He didn't write a major parish for sure. No, he wrote comments. Yes, David Fisher, you want to say? Yes. And shul, David and I were in the shul, in our shul together for many years in London. So, and we came together to Israel. So we're doing okay. So we're going down the same route. Okay, let's now move on to something, because I like in this shiurim to do a little bit of history, but also to learn a little bit of actual Divrei Torah of these great thinkers. And everyone should have a single sheet here, which says at the top, great Jewish thinkers, Tur Yaakov ben Osher, the Baal HaTurim. Can you see that? Right, okay. So, and then it says the forbidden use of shaving with razor and sideburns. Okay, let me just give you two introductions. First of all, the Baal HaTurim, or somebody called, you can see here at the top of your sheet, Rabbi Yaakov ben Osher. So he lived 200 years earlier than Rabbi Yosef Karo, right? He was born 750 years ago in Germany, and he was the son of the Rosh. The Rosh was Rabbeinu Osher, and he was the son, and he became a Rav in Germany. And later on, they moved to Spain, one of the very, very few rabbis who made the trek from Ashkenaz to Sfard. It was the Rosh. That's a whole different story. That's not my topic for the moment. But what's important is that this man, Rabbi Yaakov ben Osher, he wrote a book called The Tur. I just want to clarify the Hebrew word tur is a bit confusing in modern Hebrew because there are two words which sounds very similar. There is tur written with a tet and tor written with a taf. Okay? So when you're standing in line, it's la'amod batar in Ivrit. La'amod batar means you're standing in line on the assumption there is a line in Israel. There isn't really much lines in Israel. It's more like a rugby match, whatever it is. But the la'amod batar means you're in line. And if you want to ring up to make an appointment with a doctor, you say, "Ani rotze lahazmin tor," and that's with the taf. Taf with the Torah means to make an appointment, to stand in line, to wait for your turn. That's what Torah is. But the word, no, exactly not. The word tur with a tet means a column. That's a different word completely, right? It's not a line, it's a column. And that comes from the Chumash, where the Chumash speaks about the big day kahuna, the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, where he had a breastplate, right? One of the most dramatic items the Kohen Gadol wore was a breastplate, which had on it 12 jewels, 12 precious stones. Each one had the name of one of the tribes written on it. And that the Torah says should be written in Arba Turim, four rows. So a tur meant, tur with a tet was a row. And Arba Turin means four different rows of jewels written on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. And the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, and that's written with a tet. So a tur, so for example, if a journalist writes a column in a newspaper, that's a tur with a tet, because that's a column. Are you following me? But Lamod Bator, that's a tet with a taf. And the truth is the two are often very much confused with each other because they do mean similar things, right? That you think you're standing in a tor with whatever. Anyhow, what's important is that this man, Rabbi Yaakov ben Osher, wrote a book called The Tur. That's what he called it, The Tur. And it had four volumes to it because he wrote the Arba Turim. These are the four Turim, the four columns. And these four columns were Orach Chaim, Yeradeya, Eben HaEzer, and Choshen Mishpat. In other words, he divided up Jewish law into four different categories, right? And one was like the daily annual cycle of Davening and Shabbos, etc., and Yom Tov. And one was more Eben HaEzer, which more to do with marriage and divorce and Ksuvos, etc. And one was more Yeradeya, dealing with Kashrus and other Issa Vaheta, and Choshen Mishpat dealt with monetary law issues. And he innovated this distinction, and he wrote this book, which contained really, it was the beginnings of an attempt to do what Rabbi Yosef Karo later on completed the work of the Torah. He started, he set the, if you like, the foundations for this type of work. And then when Rabbi Yosef Karo came and he wanted to do it, the first thing he did was he wrote a commentary on the tour. Right? In other words, he went through every word that Rabbi Yaakov Osher had ever written and wrote a commentary called the Bet Yosef. The Bet Yosef is the commentary. You can see here in the sheet in front of you. So the first Hebrew paragraph says, Yoredea chapter 181, forbidden use of shaving with razor and sideburns, Hakafat HaRosh VaZakan, one of the Isurim of the Torah, is to shave with a razor. That's one issue, to shave one's face. These are only restrictions for a man. For a man to shave his face with a razor, and the other restriction is to cut off the corner, the sideburns here. To lahakif et harosh means to have a haircut which goes all the way around and shaves completely this area here. What happened subsequently was that the hair on this area here became the payas, right? Both in the Ashkenaz Hasidic world and in the Yemenite world, they developed customs of growing these long payas, which was just a sign. It became a sort of an ethnic sign that we are observant Jews, the growing of the payas, because of this law that one isn't allowed to cut this part of the what's called the sideburns from in front of the ear up to the top of the forehead. This area is not allowed to be a shaver, even not with a razor, even if you do it not with a razor, even if you do it in any other way. So there are two different isurim here, both to do with shaving. Yes. I think that's a little bit, I wouldn't put it like that. I think that's a little bit of a negative way of putting it. It's not meant like that. It's meant to say, look, we love this mitzvah so much that we want to, I'm using your term here, we want to dramatize the mitzvah a little bit, and we're not just not going to shave it, we're going to let it grow. So you have noticed that I don't have any of those curly sideburns, because I'm a Litvak, you understand? So we don't have that. But the Hasidim, and interestingly, separately from the Hasidim completely, the Yemenite Jews, you've probably seen Yemenite Jews with these, with exactly the same long payas, right? And these long payas were for them more of an ethnic issue rather than a halach. I don't think anybody even considers it to be a chumrah. It's not a chumrah. Chumrah implies there are different halachic views and you're adopting the more stringent view, right? This is a minhag which is based on an attempt to dramatize this particular mitzvah, because we love the mitzvah so much, we want to make it more dramatic. But the actual halacha is twofold. One is not to use a razor at all, and the other is to leave this leave the hair to grow and not shave it completely here. Even if what did they use before they had electric shavers? Okay, scissors. Yes, the first thing was a scissor, right? They had razors, but if razor is forbidden, what did they use? They also had certain types of creams. They had certain types of creams. Depilatory creams. You can wipe the cream on and the hair comes out. So you weren't allowed to use the cream on this area here, because you needed to have hair in this area here. And that was, why did the Torah forbid these things? Is not in the Torah, it gives us no reason at all. But if we have time today, we're gonna have a look for a minute at that. Let's read a little bit of the Hebrew text. I'll translate it for you as we go along. But you should know that the origin of this halacha is a posuk. A posuk in Parshas Kedoshim, where the posuk writes that lo takifu pa'at rosheichem. It's in Vayikra chapter 19 in Parshas Kedoshim. So it says two things in one posuk. It says lo takifu pa'at rosheichem. Lahakif comes from the word lahakafa, is a circle. Right? On Simchas Torah you make hakofas. Hakofas means to go round. So to actually cut your hair around, completely around, and to shave all this, that is one thing that is forbidden. And then the pasuk continues, "V'lo tashchit et pa'at zakanecha," and you shouldn't destroy the corners of your beard. So lahashchit means the use of a razor, and takifu means to shave, to remove the hair from this area here. I just want to mention in passing, unfortunately, sadly, there are quite a few observant Jews who are not aware of this. They're aware of the shaving with a razor thing. I think that's pretty well known. But the issue of not shaving this area here is not so well known. And I know there are quite a few people, especially people who begin to be a bit balding, they think it's nice to actually shave off the whole head, and they shave off this area as well. And by doing so, they're violating an Issur Torah, one of the Tariag Mitzvahs, by not leaving the hair from basically the cheekbone area to the top of the forehead. This area of the hair has to be left unshaved. You can trim it, like I've trimmed it, right? But you're not allowed to shave it completely. And there are people who are not aware of this halacha. And I have drawn a few people's attention to it over the years, and they were not well pleased with me drawing their attention to it. But such is life. Rabbis are not in the pleasing business. Yes. You can shave your head, but you have to leave this bit. If you don't leave this bit, then you're violating the Issur Torah of Lo Takifu Pa'as Rosh Chen. You can shave your head. You can shave your head. But you have to leave this. What? Lots of the Hasidim do in fact shave their head. Many Hasidim do sort of shave their heads, but leave this area of the hair. This area of the hair is not a rabbinic. It's min hatera. Lo sakifu pas roshem apostle in Vayikra. Okay. So you can imagine, like all halachic issues, there are lots and lots of details involved. How to cut it, when to cut it, how long is considered cut, what is, so all that. But what I want to show you here something interesting, something which caught my attention, and I want to share it with you. So let's have a look here on the sheet in front of you. So we're looking first at the Baal HaTurim. Some of you will know, incidentally, that the Baal HaTurim also wrote a commentary on the Chumash. Most Mikros Kadolos will have the Ramban and Rashi and Ibn Ezra and the Baal HaTurim, which is usually very, very succinct and enigmatic, with an amazing amount of gematrius, he had an amazing ability to analyze the language in a very brief and interesting way. That's not my topic for today. Maybe one day we'll have a shir about the tour of Yaakov ben Osher himself. So let's have a look at here. It says, Yerodea chapter 181, forbidden use of shaving with razor and sideburns, hakofas harosh vazoken, hakafat harosh. Right? So cutting around the hair on the head, v'ashchosas hazakon, and the second prohibition, which is using a razor, gamba elu kosav haramba. So the tour first starts off by citing Maimonides. Says the Rambam, she'os from hakosav, that the Torah, the Rambam gives a reason why the Torah forbade this activity. Okay? Now, the Torah doesn't give us a reason, but just as a general principle, there is a whole area of Talmud Torah which is called Ta'amei HaMitzvot. The objective is to try and find reasonable understandings of the mitzvahs, not that those reasons are the one and only reasons, but at least some way to bring this reason a bit closer to our logic. So the Torah quotes the Rambam. Kosov Rambam, Shaosram Hakosov, I'm in the first line here, Mipnesha Osim Kane Ovdi Kochovim, because the priests of various pagan worships used to do that. It was the uniform of the priests. And in actual fact, you can still see pictures, and even today, some monks, that the haircut of the monks goes round like this. Right, that it still is visible, certainly in pictures of monks from earlier generations and even today, that was the way the priests of pagan worships cut their hair. Right, ayin kaf means ad kan, end of quote. In other words, that is the end of the quote from the Rambam. V'zeh einu mefurash, right, says that the Torah is not happy with this citation from the Rambam. Why is the Rambam telling us this? How does he know this? Where does he get it from? That was the answer is, the Rambam got it from his own brain, right? The Rambam is giving us his interpretation of Ta'amei HaMitzvahs, but the Torah is not happy with it. So the Torah wrote, we don't really need reasons for mitzvahs. We do mitzvahs because the Torah tells us to. And we want to live in a way which finds favor in the eyes of God, and therefore we keep the mitzvahs. Right, so we the ain onu tzrichim levakish tana mitzvahs ki mitzvahs melechei. These are the mitzvahs of the Almighty, the King. Oleinu aflo neda tama. Even if we don't know any reasons at all. In other words, the Torah takes the view generally that it's a mistake to look for reasons of mitzvahs where the reasons are not obvious, right? In where why should the Torah forbid certain things? There is no obvious reason for it, right? The Torah forbids mixing wool and linen. And what's the reason for mixing wool and linen, right? Of shatness, right? So we don't know the reason. There are attempts to give various reasons for shatness, and I've heard and I've given shiurim on that subject, but the reasons are not obvious, right? And therefore, so Satur says, Aflo Neda Tama, we don't know the reasons, and not knowing the reasons doesn't bother me, says the Torah. Upeyas Harosh, Heimstein, he says, and when the Torah speaks about Peyas Harosh, the corners, the word peyot, then he pay aleph hay, simply means the corner. You can speak about the corner of the table. Here's the corner of the table, right? This is the peyot, right? And in fact, there is another application of peyot in halacha. What is that? A field. That's right. The corner of the field, right? There's a halacha in the Torah that if you're a farmer and you have a field, you shouldn't harvest it all the way to the end. You've got to leave the corner, right? And the corner actually can be a small corner, or how big is a corner, right? A corner can be one stalk is the corner, or it can be a yard. It can be a meter in. You can leave the corner. And that's what we say, Eilu Dvorim She'ein Lahem Shi'ur HaPeya. Right, the first thing that is mentioned in the Mishnah is something which ain't lehem shiur. It doesn't matter. There's no maximum amount for it. You just have to leave something, right? So the peyah simply means a corner. So here in the Torah, it means pa'as zekonecha, is the corner of the beard. If this is the facial beard, this is the corner, right? These are the corners of it. Okay, I'm not going to do, let's skip to the next, to the last two lines here, where the tour continues. It's because of a Rambam. You see that? I'm looking at the last two lines of the first paragraph. The Katav HaRambam, She'enu Chayev Elo Bata. The Rambam writes that this restriction of shaving, the forbidden, Taf Ayin Reish, is a razor, where it cuts directly on the skin, right? Avo B'misparayim. Misparayim are scissors. To do it with scissors, ke'ein tar means even if the result is similar to that of a razor, even if you've got a pair of scissors which can cut very, very close to the skin, that's fine. Now, so long as the hair is cut by two blades cutting it like this, that's okay. What the Torah forbids is one blade cutting it against the skin. That's awesome. That's what the Rambam writes, and that's indeed what we practice. We use electric shavers. Electric shavers work on the basis of two blades, right? It's not cutting against the skin. It is two blades cutting, even though it's very smooth, right? And the manufacturers of shavers advertise just how wonderfully smooth it is, right? But in actual fact, this is the Rambam's view that even so long as you're using a double blade, a misparayim, then even if it's ke'ein tar, even if the result is similar to that of a blade, it's nevertheless permitted. I'll just continue here, these last two lines here. And there's Vov Aleph Aleph. So Aleph Aleph, I've mentioned to you a few times before, is one of those acrostics, Aleph Rosh Tavis, which you've got to be a bit careful with because it can mean lots of different things. So Aleph Aleph in Hebrew can either mean E'ef Shar, which means it's impossible, or it can mean Avraham Avinu. Sometimes a reference to Avraham Avinu is Aleph Aleph, right? Sometimes it can mean Ashes Ish, a married woman, which is also important to know if that's what it means. You've got to, the all important halachas. So Aleph Aleph is a tricky one. But here in the tour, Aleph Aleph means something very specific. Aleph Aleph for the tour means Adoni Ovi, which means my father, my teacher. Avi is my father. Adoni means my master, my father, my teacher. So he cites his father, who was called the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, who was his Rebbe as well as his father. So when he, Adoni Obi Horosh Zal, he says, my father, my teacher, of blessed memory, Katav, Shagamba Misparayim Nami Chayim Apeyas. That Misparayim are also no good. If the result is a smooth result, then even scissors are no good. So the Rosh would not allow electric shavers, right? And therefore, so here you have already an interesting example. When 200 years later, the Rabbi Yosef Karo is coming to write the Shulchan Aruch, he has to decide, is he going to follow the Rambam, who allows in modern terms, electric shavers, or is he going to follow the Rosh who doesn't allow electric shavers? Are you following me? So what is he going to decide? Rabbi Yosef Karo later on, 200 years later, is going to have to write his version of a Shulchan Aruch, and there will be a school of thought following the Rambam and a school of thought following the Rosh, right? And indeed, that's why, just by the way, in a more Hasidic world and in certain worlds, growing a beard is considered mandatory. It's not considered a chumrah because of this problem. Because in the halakha itself, there are opinions that you're not allowed to shave the way we shave with electric shavers, that you have to grow at least a small beard because of the view of the Rosh. Are you following me? But what happened? Rabbi Yosef Karo, 200 years later, wrote the Shulchan Aruch. And in it, he writes that the consensus view follows Maimonides, follows the Rambam. Are you following me? And therefore, with a scissors, or the modern version of the scissors, which is an electric shaver, that's fine. Right? But that's only because Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote, Rabbi Yosef Karo collated the different views, are you following me? And he said, this is the consensus view, that you can use misparayim. And so long as you're using misparayim, even if the result is smooth, that's fine. Let's just go do something else. Let's just go do something else. That was a different pagan practice, or it was a form of avilut, in mourning, an avel. In mourning, they used to, in grief, they would cut themselves. They would cut their skin. They would inflict self-harm on themselves as part of a mourning process. That was considered to be a great honor for the deceased if the people who were mourning him or her cut themselves as a sign of the immensity of their grief. And that's what the Torah forbids. Okay, that's a different thing completely. Tattooing is a third issue. It's neither the if you don't mind, I don't want to go into that. It is actually a different subject. Tattooing, permanent tattoos are not permitted. But a lot of tattooing today is pretty temporary anyway. Anyhow, but one of the interesting things you see here is, yes, Mike. It doesn't. The bottom line is it's actually a unique mitzvah, because we know that with the positive mitzvahs of the Torah, the mitzvot asei, right? There are a few, not many, mitzvahs like tzitzis and tefillin and things which don't apply to women, right? But when it comes to lo taser, the restrictions of the Torah, the what's forbidden in the Torah, that applies across the board to men and women. You know, if it's forbidden to eat chametz on Pesach or forbidden to make a fire on Shabbos, that's no different to all the prohibitions of the Torah, except for this one. This one is an exception to the rule that the cutting of the... No. Both of these issues, without going into great details here, both of these issues, both the leaving this hair and using the razor, are prohibitions which don't apply to women. Now, women are allowed to shave if they want to. They can shave their head completely, and they can use a razor if they need to. That it doesn't apply to them. Why it's like that is a whole page in the Talmud, not for now. Anyhow, the bottom line here is that you see here, interestingly, that the Torah is bringing us the two main schools of thought on the subject. And he leaves it an open question. He says, my father, the Rosh, says like this, the Rambam says that, and he moves on. He doesn't bring you a conclusion. Right? And that's why the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, decided that's not good enough. We're going to have to give conclusions based on consensus views. And that's one of the reasons you're right. But what I'm also interested in is the original paragraph here where the Baal HaTurim criticizes the Rambam. And says, why is the Rambam bringing reasons for a mitzvah that has no reasons? Who's interested in reasons? We don't need reasons, right? Now, the search for reasons was a classic part of, if you like, what we generally call rationalist Judaism. The Rambam was the greatest proponent of rationalist Judaism, that Judaism should be and can be understood in great detail in many different ways, and one should try wherever possible to find ta'amei ha-mitzvot. Some of you might be familiar with the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch was written, right, following the Rambam, going through all 613 mitzvahs, giving you a reason for each one. Whether it's a reason you're happy with or not happy with is a separate question. That's not the issue. The issue is it's possible to find reasons. And I want to have a look at the Beit Yosef. Right, so we're getting now to Rabbi Yosef Karo. Can you see halfway down your sheet, is written Bet Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo. Remember that the Bet Yosef was the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch. Before he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he first sat down and learned the whole tour and wrote a commentary on the tour, which is called the Bet Yosef. So let's read this for a moment. Hakofas harosh vashchosas hazakan, gam be'elu kosav harambam. Here also the Rambam wrote, she'osrom hakosav, that why does the Torah forbid it? B'nei she'osin kein ovdei kochavim umazolas, besof hilchas avodah zarah. Okay, so he's first quoting the Rambam, like the Torah, that the Rambam says, because we want to show that we are not similar to the priests of the pagan worship. So far, I've quoted just the Rambam. Now he continues in the second line. Uma sha'amar Rabbeinu. And what the Rav said. So of course, he's writing a commentary on the Torah. So Rabbeinu means the Torah. V'zeh einu mefurush. V'ein onu tzrichim levakesh tam lemitzvus. That, and when the Torah writes that he's upset with the Rambam, and that why is he trying to find reasons for mitzvahs of these nature? So I put the next two lines in heavy print. Devarav mevurarim, it's clear from his words, shedato lachlok Rambam. And his view is he takes issue with the Rambam, that Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher is arguing with the Rambam. Lama levakish lo tam midato. Why should we try and look for a reason of our own accord? L'shum mitzvah, for any mitzvah, shednira she'ilu lo hoyu yodim tama mitzvah, lo hoyinu mitzuvim la'asosam. Because one could come to the wrong conclusion that if you don't know a reason for a mitzvah, you don't have to do it. In other words, if we're only doing mitzvahs because we find them reasonable, then at the end of the day, that's not serving God. That's just doing what we consider to be reasonable. If it's not reasonable, we're basically serving ourselves. We're only doing what we want to do, because we understand why it's important. But the minute we don't understand why it's important, we're not willing to do it. So that is the view of the Turim. But he says, "Ve'ein hadavar kei." Right? Ki mitzvos melachim oleinu. So in the first paragraph here of the Bet Yosef, he's simply quoting the Rambam and quoting the objections of the Baal HaTurim. But in the second paragraph, are you with me? He says, Vani Omer. Can you see that? The second paragraph in the Bet Yosef. Vani Omer. And I say, so this is Rabbi Yosef Karo now giving us his opinion. The Chaslei LaRambam, it means Chas V'Sholem, that the Rambam should be doing what the Torah accuses him of. Milamizba Hochid, the Rambam, of course, does not believe that the reasons that he gives for the mitzvahs are the definitive reasons, and that if you don't want the reason, you don't have to do the mitzvah. Who is greater than the Rambam? You see here some very interesting ideas of the Yosef Kara. Who could be greater than the Rambam in his respect for every detail of every mitzvah? Right? And the Rambam writes commentary at the end of Hilchos Me'ilah. I won't go into it now. So I'm now into the heavy print. I've highlighted the print in the second paragraph. So my view is, so this is Rabbi Yosef Karo telling us his view, which is really echoing the Rambam. And I brought this to show you that actually Rabbi Yosef Karo was extremely loyal to the Hashkafas and the Halachas of the Rambam. For him, the Rambam, Maimonides, was really the foundation on which the whole Halachic system was built. That's not to say he always followed the Rambam. If there was a consensus not like the Rambam, he would sometimes bring down the Rambam's view in the Shulchan Aruch and say, but we're going down, there is a consensus different to him. But you couldn't move without Maimonides from Yosef Karo. And here he says in the heavy print, She'af al-pi, even though, She'kol chukei ha-Torah gezeiras melachein, of course it's true, he says, that all the mitzvahs of the Torah are a gezeirat melech, are a divine decree. Mikol mokam, nevertheless, it still remains true, and here comes the important line, Kol ma she'yucha levakesh lo tam nomar botam. Wherever we can find any sort of reason, we should look for reasons. Why should we look for reasons? Because, he says, not because we won't do them if we don't know a reason. That's not why. We're looking for reasons because that's called Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah is one branch of Talmud Torah is to delve into the meanings of the mitzvahs and understand reasons for them. And I'm sure many of you are aware that over the centuries, for example, you can read the writings of Rosh Shamson Raphael Hirsch in the 19th century, came up with new reasons. New reasons. We learned it this year. We learned reason that Shamson Raphael Hirsch came up with new reasons for mitzvahs, which no one had ever said before, right? And that's called Talmud Torah. Learning Torah means you can come up with new insights and new reasons for mitzvahs. And the Rosh of Karo is upset that the tour will say, we don't need reasons for mitzvahs. He considers that to be a sort of an anti-rational or anti-intellectual approach to Torah. Let's try and find reasons. And there are always reasons there. And often there are layers upon layers of mitzvahs, right? Of reasons, right? And then in the last paragraph, he says, umikol mokom, look at the last paragraph here. Vov mem mem means umikol mokom. He says, and nevertheless, despite the fact that I feel that in principle there should be a, we should look for reasons, but mitzvah midato. My view here is in this particular case, the Rambam wasn't just dreaming up a reason on a blank sheet of paper. That was his reason because it's part of pagan practices. Elamidasa kosov. He's learning the psukim in Parshas Kedoshim. Basically, I'll just cut this short. He says, if you look in the context, where does the Torah tell us about this prohibition to cut the hair in this particular way? The posuk before it and the posuk after it deals with specific pagan practices, which are forbidden to us, right? And therefore, the Rambam is learning context in the Chumash. It's not in the text, but it's in the context. What do we see here? Let's just summarize here the last couple of minutes of the Shia. Very simply, that Rav Yosef Karo took this sefer called the Tur, and he made out of it the basis for his Shulchan Aruch. His Shulchan Aruch is structured on the writings of the Tur, simply in the number of chapters it's got, in the division into four different Sforim, the Arba Turim. He also has Or Chaim, Yeredeia, Evin Ezer, Chesed Mishpat. All this comes from the Torah. But what he's done is he's taken the work of Rabbi Yaakov ben Osher one stage further. He's saying, I'm not just going to bring down various different views. I'm going to go deeper into the full spectrum of halachic views. And then I'm going to give a consensus decision based on, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that his view was that there were three amudei hora'ah. There were three principles of halacha. One was the Rambam, one was the Rif from Alfasi from Morocco. Alfasi simply means from Fez, right? The Yitzhak Alfasi was the Rif. And then the third one was the Rosh. So the Rosh, the Rif, and the Rambam, as far as he's concerned, when there was a multitude of different views, he would look at these three Rabbonim as if they were sitting in front of him. That's what he writes. As if I'm sitting in a Beis Din, and I have in front of me the Rambam, the Rosh, and the Rif. And I know what they say because I've got their writings in front of me. In his head, he had it all balper, all verbatim in his head. And I will judge two out of three. I'll make a consensus on the basis of two out of three. And that's how he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. But you can see here, he didn't abandon the rationalism of the Rambam. He stayed loyal to the Rambam, which it's difficult to express in the last minute of the Shia just how extraordinary that is, because actually, and I touched on this last week, and I'll look at it again next week, Rabbi Yosef Karo himself was a Kabbalist. In other words, he was in Tzfat, and he was involved in the Kabbalistic life of Tzfat in the 1500s. He invested his life's productive work, not in Kabbalah, but in Halacha. But in his personal life, he shared the life of the Kabbalists. And therefore, you would have thought that rationalism was not his way of thinking. And yet, he managed to find that combination. He lived in a Kabbalistic world, but at the same, and he cites occasionally from the Zohar, but his Hashkafa stuck with the Rambam and the rationalist approach. And that balance was another unique feature of the Shulchan Aruch, which made it so acceptable across the board in the Jewish world. Ad Hayom Hazeh, to this day, 500 years later, it is the textbook for all of us, for our Jewish life. That's it for today, ladies and gentlemen. Please go on next week. We will continue with Rabbi Yosef Karo and one or two other examples. Thank you very much.